And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. It's a country that has been rarely out of the news headlines for the past, well, many years. It seems to get much more negative than positive press, especially these days. It's given words to the international lexicon like Beluga, Glasnost and Gulag, consummate writers like Dostoevsky and Pushkin, and matchless composers like Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, Stravinsky and Shostakovich. For the past 20 years, it's been led by Vladimir Putin and a tight clique of powerful people around him, which brooks little opposition. The world saw a brutal example of this just last week. Today, for the first time, I attempt to shine a light on Russia with the help of a knowledgeable journalist and commentator. She's been dubbed as one of the 100 top influencers in French-speaking Switzerland. In 2007, she co-founded NashaGazeta.ch, which means our newspaper, the first Russian language online daily in Switzerland. She's a highly experienced journalist, at ease with top people in politics, science, and the arts, Russian-European relations. You might also have heard her on the radio or TV. I could go on and on. She's also a PhD in history from Moscow's Lomonosov State University, an academic institution with almost 270 years old, a tradition that has produced 11 Nobel Prize winners, from what I've read. And she's a dual national, Russian and Swiss, now living in Geneva since 1998, after 10 years in Paris when she worked with UNESCO. Nadia Sikorsky, welcome to the McKay Interview. Thanks so much for inviting me to your home. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, Michael. I'm very honored to be the first Russian to be interviewed by you.
Well, it's long overdue, isn't it? Long overdue.
This we will see.
Nadia, with your profound and personal understanding of Russia, how would you explain to me, in an audience which does not have your depth of knowledge, the consequences of the tragic death, murder perhaps, of Alexei Navalny, the ill-fated and courageous Kremlin critic in an Arctic prison camp just a few days ago?
Well, I would first pick up on the word ill-fated. I don't think he's ill-fated. I think he chose his fate in a very determined way. And this is why we should praise his courage. Because when he returned from Germany after being poisoned back to Russia, I think it was obvious to him, like to everybody else, that he will be put to jail. Probably we didn't expect this to happen straight at the airport upon his arrival, but it was quite inevitable. Unfortunately, after he was imprisoned for 19 years and sent to this horrible place beyond the polar circle, it was also foreseeable that he will not survive. But when the news broke last Friday of his death, it still came as a horrible shock to me and to everybody I know. As to the consequences, well, I think the oppression in Russia will only intensify because the impunity that Mr. Putin benefits from just pushes him to advance on this road. And his impunity comes from the fact that, unlike all the Western leaders, he doesn't have to worry about winning the election. The election is already won, and some analysts already even given the result. He will have over 80% of votes. So what does he care? This is basically it. And if the oppression intensifies in Russia, it might well lead to the intensification of his aggressive policy beyond the Russian borders. And so, unfortunately, I understand, especially the countries who have an experience of being part of the Soviet Union, like the Baltic states and Poland and Finland, I understand their reactions, to my great regret, because I really would much prefer to see Russia very different.
I hope this doesn't sound like a silly question, Nadia, but if he's in such an entrenched position of power, why go to the trouble of killing the man?
This is the question I ask myself. And many people and many commentators ask the same question. So it's not a silly question. I can only give you a silly answer, which I really don't have. Yeah. I think, because, you know, I think when people behave the way Putin behaves, in some way they cover a very profound complex of inferiority. Because really strong people who are sure of themselves, they don't have to prove themselves to the world by force. We can say this about individuals as of the countries and of the individuals which represent the countries and act on their behalf.
I agree with you, yeah.
So I think despite all this bravado and all this show, you know, he's now everywhere, you know, on every poster, on every billboard in Moscow.
In Moscow,
from
right.
what
yeah.
I see. Yeah. Behind all this, I think he still felt threatened by Navalny, by his popularity, by his unprecedented courage, because this guy acted without any safety net.
Yes.
And I think this is something Putin just cannot absorb. And since Stalin is his idol, he applied the same method, very known, no man, no problem.
Yeah.
So basically, no. I think this is it.
Thank you. Thanks for that explanation. It was kind of clearer and simple, but quite complicated in terms of the way that men, and sad to say, it's usually men that behave that way. Let's go to, you know, your day-to-day life here. Tell me about your newspaper. What stories do you write to Russians in Russia, and what kind of stories do you write about Switzerland, and who reads those stories?
Well, first of all, I don't write stories for Russians in Russia.
Okay.
Probably I should take you a few years back, or precisely back to 2007, when I was offered by Edipresse at the time. The Edipresse was a publishing house based in Lausanne, which owned practically all the French-speaking newspapers in Switzerland. So they approached me and proposed to create this first online Russian language media.
I see.
Yeah, so it wasn't my idea. So I was invited to develop the concept from the scratch, to create the site and basically, you know, to run this thing, which I did with great pleasure, although first I refused.
And so that was 2007.
Seven. Yeah. So you can imagine 2007 was one of those short and rare periods in history when everybody was in love with Russia, especially in Switzerland, yes. especially the Swiss banks and the Swiss private clinics. You know, Russians were very welcome and the red carpet was rolled in front of them.
So just briefly remind me and our audience why the love affair at that time?
Well, because it was quite calm, you know, there was nothing big happening. And, you know, there was still hope that Russia will be a civilized country. I mean, I remember when Putin was elected, some of my acquaintances here, the descendants of the great Russian families, you know, who had to leave Russia after the 1917 revolution, but remained very patriotic. I remember those people who really should have known better telling me, oh, but Putin, he's a young guy, he's a modern guy, he lived abroad, he speaks German, he's civilized. Russia will be great again. Well, we know.
They said that to you, didn't they?
Yes. Wow. And I told them from day one that a mediocre KGBist cannot bring any good news in the long run.
I can imagine that you're quite sad. You must feel sad to be proved right.
I am so sad to be proved right,
yes, exactly.
You know, although I like being right.
And tell me a bit more
about
the kind of stories that you write about Switzerland.
So basically the idea was to create, because what happened, there was lots of Russians already at the time and their number was increasing and they had important buying power, as you can imagine, but also intellectual power, because we have the habit of just talking about the rich Russians, but many Russians who came to Switzerland at the time were intellectuals and they became professors of leading universities. They came as students who then remained as professors or researchers or artists or writers. So it was an important kind of bulk of newcomers. And most of them, if they spoke any foreign language, it was mostly English. So I think the idea of Edipresse was to help them integrate in the Swiss life. And so my purpose initially was to explain Switzerland to them, not the other way around.
Yeah, sure.
Especially, you can imagine that for the, and not only to Russians from Russia, but to the whole Russian-speaking world, which is, of course, much broader than Russia. This is why when we decided to create this newspaper, my Swiss colleagues wanted absolutely to have in its title something Russian, like the Russian newspaper.
Yes.
And I said, there is no need to rub it in. I said, you know, people will understand that if this paper is in Russian, there is something to do with Russia. But I insisted on the fact that I wanted the newspaper to be a unifying platform for all the people from the ex-Soviet Union who don't despise Russian language or culture and who are happy to communicate with it or at least to read with it in it, because you can do it anonymously. This is the advantage of the internet publication. This is why it's called Our Newspaper, to unite all of us.
To all of us through the language. Just very quickly before I go on to my next question, roughly speaking, how many Russians are there living in Switzerland? Roughly, I have no idea.
This is the bingo question.
Bingo. Oh, I didn't mean to ask you a bingo question.
I have no idea.
No idea. Okay.
I mean, a couple of years before the war, according to some statistics I was able to get, there were probably 50,000 of just Russians.
Yes.
Not to count Russian speakers.
Yes.
Once again, I underline this this subtlety.
That's an important point. So what do we who do not know, or at least hardly know, Russia? It's a vast country, and I just mentioned this again to people who may not be aware, spanning 11 time zones, if that's correct, over 140 million inhabitants. What do we need to understand about that country? What are the fundamental and the rudimentary points of information of history that we must be aware of in order to begin to understand Russia? Put another way, you must talk to lots and lots of non-Russian people. What do you often find yourself correct and say, but you need to be aware of this. We, the foreigners, fall into the same mistake of misunderstanding Russia? I know that's a big question, but...
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
I'm quite used to this question, and
I'm
very often, especially since the last 2 years, asked about how come the Russians tolerate all this in, you know, under the comments, all this.
I understand.
And then I have to remind the foreigners who don't probably know, as you say, very well Russian history, that slavery was only abolished in Russia in 1862.
So quite recent.
Quite recent. And then they hated the Tsar who did it. And then they hated Gorbachev, who gave them freedom, at least provisional, last century.
Yeah.
This is the particularity of Russian mentality. And I think it has to do with many things. First of all, as I said, with the centuries of real slavery, which...
And when you say slavery, not feudalism, but where the owner owned the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the famous Gogol's novel, The Dead Souls.
Yeah.
The owner owned the souls, you know. They were called the souls, the individuals that were
right
owned.
Right, the very fabric
they were
of the people.
Owned... by landlords, you know, they had no papers, they had no, of course, passports, they had no rights, so they were assigned to this person who could trade any individual for a piece of art or for a cow or for a horse or whatever. So
like
it was real slavery.
In the southern states of America.
Exactly.
For Africans and in the West Indies where I come from, the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But until so very recently, relatively.
Yeah.
Also, another thing is the Orthodox faith.
Oh, really?
Of course, because it's based on dogma. It's you don't ask questions. You follow. And in a sense, this explains, if you think about it, why the transition from the Orthodox faith, which was predominant before the revolution, the passage to the communist regime was, in fact, so easy. Because communism regime was also based on dogma, no questions asked. So people who were used not to ask any questions continued not to ask any questions, and they continue to do so. And I think this is the tragedy of the Russian people and the curse, you know, which brings them to the situation that we're in today.
Okay. And do you visit Russia often? Is it safe for you to go there?
Well, I probably wouldn't go now.
Hmm.
No, I last was there in 2021 to say goodbye to the dean of my school, who was my mentor from my very first day in the university and who became really my role model and a very, very dear friend.
I understand.
He passed away.
My guest today is Nadia Sikorsky, co-founder and editor-in-chief of NashaGazeta.ca, a Russian language online newspaper based here in Geneva. It may sound like an odd question, but again, it's an obvious question for me who, although I've been to Russia a few times, to Moscow a couple of times, to St. Petersburg, but I ask you anyway, what does the rule of law actually mean in the Russian state today, and was it ever better in recent times?
It means nothing.
It means nothing.
Today, and in recent times, if you think of Putin's period, it didn't mean anything. But I was lucky enough to belong to Gorbachev generation because I finished my high school in 85,
yeah,
just when he came to power, and I entered university. So I really was lucky enough to live through these tremendous changes, which were so promising, but ended the way we know they ended.
I understand. And what do you, I mean, again, this is an impossible question for you to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. And I know you don't have a crystal ball and you don't have a degree in psychology, you have a degree in history. What do you think Vladimir Putin wants? Is he really in power or just the face of power?
Well, I think to answer this question, you don't need neither crystal ball nor degree in psychology, but a degree in clairvoyance.
Okay. You know? Okay. I'm not sure if any universities give that degree.
At least not Moscow University, definitely not, you know. So I don't have this either.
But tell me what you see when you look at it.
Honestly, yeah? I have no idea.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why is he doing what he is doing today. We have the biggest country in the world, as you say. We have 11 time zones. A huge part of this country is yet to be developed. There is so much work to do to improve the lives of people there, because most foreigners, when they visit, they go to Moscow and St. Petersburg. These are beautiful cities. I'm a Moscovite, and I love my city, and I love my country, although I'm very much opposed to what's going on in it today, in and with outside. But why he does it, I don't know. And you know, if you think about it cynically, I can more or less bet that if his idea truly was to reestablish the Soviet Union, I don't think it's possible, at least not in its entirety. But I think if his idea really was that, he could have been much more effective by increasing the pensions of Russian people to a decent amount of money, which would attract many people from the former Soviet Republic to come back. Because not only in Russia, but in many other places, including Ukraine, people lived in relative poverty, you know? And not only there. Mm. Last summer I visited, for example, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan. Well, in Armenia, the situation is very, very difficult. But people are wonderful, and they really counted on Russia's support. And now they feel betrayed.
Yes, I've been there.
The same in Georgia. Yeah. So instead of doing everything to attract these peoples by peaceful, economical means, he now brought us to the situation when all our neighbors and former allies hate Russia and Russians with it. And this is the worst political outcome that, in my opinion, we could come to.
So generosity could well have brought about the objective which he claims he has.
Well,
yeah,
he can claim.
Yeah. I hate to continue a conversation using essentially negative words, but I think you can understand why, given what's going on now. What are the hidden dangers for the West, for NATO too, in misunderstanding Putin and his intent? And what do Russians see as the hidden dangers from the West?
Well, you know, it's such a twisted question. I mean, we live in a very twisted world where everybody lies. Unfortunately, Putin is not the only politician who lies, and he is not the only one who is not to be trusted. Personally, I haven't yet met a politician, and I've met many whom I would trust. So, but the net result is that even though people may disagree with Trump or Biden or whoever comes next, etc., or may disagree with Macron or whoever else is leading in Europe, the flux of migration goes to the West and not to Russia.
That's right.
Which...
Big time.
Big time. You know, big time. Yeah. So there must be something that the West does right, although it also makes many mistakes and Russia does wrong.
I suspect you have the answer on the tip of your tongue.
No.
No.
But if you think that Russians are afraid of the West, I wouldn't say that. Because, you know, when I was studying, it was still the Soviet Union, and my major was American literature. My professor, who I went to see off, you know, 2 days ago, he was the first Fulbright scholar in the Soviet Union. He was one of the major specialists in American literature and media. I think he knew at the time every living American writer. Our studio, our TV studio at my school, was equipped entirely by Ted Turner personally.
Really?
Because he met him and loved my professor.
My God.
You know, so, and all this was happening. It was still the Soviet Union. My course of Russian and American literature, of American and English literature, was 3 years long. We really studied it in depth. And I think, to come back to your previous question, what the Westerners should do to understand Russia better, I would say to learn Russian culture, to read Russian classics, because most of the answers are there.
Okay, that's good advice, good advice. But I'm going to just be a little bit more persistent on the Western possible mistakes. I mean, in your opinion, if the governments, Western governments, made mistakes in those relationships with Russia since the collapse of the USSR, 1991, I think it was, if those Western leaders should have behaved differently, in your opinion, please, with the benefit of hindsight, okay, that's a luxury, but why not? Give me some examples of mistakes which are prominent in your memory, mistakes that the West has made over the last 20, 30 years.
I think the West made, indeed, several major mistakes. First of all, I think the West should get a better hearing aid, because it never listened to Putin. Putin outlined his program already at the famous Munich summit, to which he was at the time invited, unlike the one we just had now. So I don't understand why Georgia came as a surprise, why Chechnya came as a surprise, and why Crimea came as a surprise, and now Ukraine came as a surprise.
Because he basically told people, he telegraphed it.
He outlined his program very clearly, but nobody would listen. And everybody was saying, he will never do this. And when you see in front of you a person like Putin, who I'm sure is full of complexes, we come back to what I just said previously, well, you don't put the red cloth in front of the bull. You just don't. Because when you provoke and provoke and provoke, well, he finally bites it, you know? And I think he made a huge mistake by biting and invading Ukraine, because now, whatever were the provocations, it doesn't matter anymore. Because now he rendered Ukraine white and untouchable, and nothing can repair that. And now I'm being the, you know, in a sense, the advocate of the devil. But I'm just understanding. I'm just trying to explain how I see this. The mistakes that the West made, apart from not listening, was also humiliating Russia.
And Russia. I've heard this before from other people, but not with your knowledge. Give me an example or two.
Well,
please.
I mean, not inviting him to the celebration of the liberation of Auschwitz, which was liberated by the Russian army. It was a very stupid diplomatic mistake.
I'd forgotten that, honestly. Yeah,
yes.
I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
You know, this is just one.
Yeah.
And there were others. There were others. And this so plays to him, because it gives him the arguments to say to the Russians, who are very nationalistic, and every Russian family went through the Second World War, and every family suffered from it.
More than 20 million.
So when these kind of stupid things happen, it gives him the argument to say, you see, they don't even recognize that we won the war. And this works immediately like an engine, you know, every time. But what I was really shocked by, even more recently, is the way the West disrespected Mikhail Gorbachev, who gave the West everything it wanted, and absolutely, then what let down. And the way, when I realized that the only Western leader who came to his funeral was Mr. Orban, who is a black sheep in Europe.
From Hungary.
Well, this really, you know, kind of makes you wonder.
Yeah. No, you put it very well, very forcefully. Again, another question which you might sort of roll your eyes when you hear it, and raise your eyebrows as you are now.
Unfortunately, nobody
across.
Will see it.
This is why I'm glad we don't have television. But do you feel that Russians really are intimidated in that system that they live in, or are they just oblivious to the day-to-day politics that govern their country because they've just got more pressing things to worry about? Or is my understanding just a little bit naive as a man looking from the outside in?
You're not naive. It's a valid question. But I think that there is no homogeneous Russian people.
There's 140 million of them. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's very difficult to put them in the same pot.
Okay,
you know?
Urban Russians. Could I say urban Russians? St. Petersburg Russians, Moscovites?
Yeah,
what about
I
that?
Think those suffer much more than somebody in provinces.
They but suffer more?
From the power, of
from
course.
From the power,
but of course.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I often compare Russia and the United States, two superpowers. But when you look deep down, I was looking for some statistics, and I was very surprised to discover that only 37% of Russians have the what we call foreign passport, the second passport you need for traveling abroad. But then I discovered that only 37% of Americans have passports at all.
Exactly.
So in a sense, they are very much alike. Basically, they don't care much about the rest of the world. They have huge countries, which will probably take them lifetime to visit already. But most of them never travel even within their countries.
That's right. Absolutely correct. Yeah.
And you have, in both countries, like in America, you have probably 10% of top elite of the world, also because Americans were clever enough to attract all the minds of the world, not only born in America, but of the world, all the talents, and providing them with the conditions to reveal their talents and make them work for the benefit of the United States. I don't have to remind you that Sergei Brin is of Russian origin. And Russia does exactly the opposite. It lets all its talents go, you know, and in a very pejorative way. They just say, oh, Russia is big, we have other talents. Well, one day there won't be any left.
That's right. That's
and
right.
This, for me, is another internal tragedy of the country. Because from what I know, since the beginning of the war, more than 50,000 scientists left Russia. Only scientists.
That was mentioned on another program about Ukraine, the number of talented people.
So this is it.
Yeah.
So this is it. So I think that intellectual, educated Russians who have traveled, who have seen the world, of course they are intimidated by the system, especially that since the sanctions imposed by the West, unfortunately, they don't punish the oligarchs who all have 3-4 passports in their back pockets and they can still travel, whatever. It punishes the middle class, whose opinion Putin never asked before starting the war. But they are suffering the most. And I think this is very unfortunate.
And the last question, again, an obvious question, Nadia, is how can matters improve for the Russian people?
Well, it can only improve from within. It can only improve with the change of power, because it's clear that this regime will not change. And, you know, I hear sometimes even my country persons who call to revolution. Well, I understand.
They call for revolution.
Yes. Yeah. I understand the strive for a change. But the word revolution personally scares me a lot, because when you remember what happened after our last revolution over the century ago, which led to the civil war and the horrible years of repressions, well, I would think twice. I would very much hope, as somebody who really profoundly loves Russia and loves Russian culture, which I've been promoting all my life, I really hope that there will be another way but bloody revolution to get down with the current regime.
Now, do we leave on that note of optimism and not naive optimism? You say it with great feeling. I can see that and I can hear that. And I thank you so much for answering all my questions so genuinely and in such a straightforward manner. My guest today has been Dr. Nadia Sikorsky, co-founder and editor-in-chief of NashaGazeta.ch, an online Russian Russian language newspaper based here in Geneva. Thank you, Nadia.
Thank you very much, Michael, for this opportunity.
That was The McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.